Session number 10152, reel 3.
Commander Kingham, reel 3.
As I was saying, the CEO Saunders rang up ops to complain about this business being shot at the whole time. So ops got through to the battery commander, and he said he was frightfully sorry, but it was too good an opportunity to miss. So that was that. So at least we made some contribution to the war effort by providing a local anti-aircraft battery with some target practice. Live target practice for once. It's going back to what we were talking about earlier on about the age of pilots and the experience of pilots. And just to say that there were about, I can only recall three pilots, I mean, I'm sure there must have been more, who came in who either started off as older men. By older men, I mean they were 30 and we were all 20. And who were successful. Sailor Milan, of course, was the great. To my mind, he was part of the greatest fighter pilot we had. And he was 30. And he was a brilliant leader and a very determined, dogged chap and a great friend of mine. But he, of course, had been in fighter command when it started, so he didn't come into it from fresh. But the other chap who does stand out was Jamie Rankin, you may have heard of. And he came, and oddly enough, he took over from me as CEO of 92 Squadron. And he came from training command, and he was in his early 30s, and we regarded him as on, you know, as on the way out at that sort of age, as you do when you're 20. And he became one of the great wing leaders. He died, unfortunately, a few years back. But apart from him, apart from those two, there's Johnny Kent also, who did quite well. He came to 92 Squadron as well at one stage. But he had been operational before. But normally speaking, it was quite true that the old pilots who came in from outside and from other commands just didn't last. And I would like to make the point that the 92 Squadron, I think, was in the firing line longer than any other squadron. It was certainly officially credited with the most successes. And the reason it stayed in so long was because our social life at Biggin Hill was too good for us to let it be broken up. We had a marvelous station commander called Dickie Grice.
Dickie Grice.
Died after the war, unfortunately. And he used to say, okay, isn't time you moved off for rest? And we said, absolutely no way, thank you. We're having much too good a time socially to be moved on, which is why we stayed so long. Because most squadrons, I think, went for 2 or 3 weeks, and 92 was there from the end of August right the way through to the end. And then stayed on Biggin Hill for many more months. I was Biggin Hill for 2 years before I moved across to Kennedy as wing leader.
Moved across to
Kenley, RAF Kenley, which is 5 miles west of Biggin Hill. And I was wing leader there in the last half of 42.
Moving on to 42 now, in February of that year, there was a notorious incident where the Scharnhorst and Meissenau burst through the Straits of Dover. Can you tell me if you took any part in that action?
I can. I was CO of 72 Squadron at the time. Part of the Biggin Hill wing, and we had been pushed out to Gravesend Aerodrome, a small aerodrome just south of Thames Estuary. And we were billeted in a marvellous house belonging to the Earls of Darnley. And we were there at this particular time, which I can't recall the exact time, but it would be in the early part of 42.
February, yeah.
February 42. And one day we were called to cockpit readiness. They said, there's something on, get into your cockpits, hang on. So in we got, and we waited, and then a few minutes later they put us back to half an hour readiness from standby. And then the minutes went by, and we put back in standby, and then back to half an hour readiness. And this happened about 3 or 4 times. And finally, I was called to the phone, and ops were there, and they said, we want you to hightail it down to Manston as quickly as you can, where 2 other Spitfire squadrons will join you. You'll find 6 swordfish and escort them into the channel where they are going to attack a small flotilla of E-boats. So we scrambled there as quickly as we could. We rushed down to Manston. We orbited Manston. There were six Swordfish already orbiting there. No other Spitfires in sight. And as soon as the Swordfish saw us, they turned and headed southeast, and we followed them. And the weather was miserable. It was one of those days when one moment visibility, there was squalls and you couldn't see anything. The next moment it cleared and you could see a little bit. And there was a sort of cloud base. I don't know, I can't remember, but it was sort of one of those ragged cloud bases of about 1,000. And we sat above these Swordfish, who, as you know, are amazingly slow aircraft and extremely vulnerable to everything. And we were waiting for them to find a flotilla of E-boats. And all of a sudden, I found myself, because we were ahead of the Swordfish then, sort of orbiting and circling around them, sitting over, it suddenly loomed out of the mist, and I found myself sitting over an extremely good-looking battleship or a cruiser. And I called up my squadron. I said, "My son, look at this bloody thing. I never knew the Navy had such a marvellous ship." And it was at that time, it was pointing due west back towards England. And I thought it was one of the naval ships that was playing around or whatever. I didn't know. I never quite knew what the other services were up to. And then there were two or three huge explosions beside it, which I learnt afterwards were those amazing Dover guns, which fired, I think, by radar or RDF, as it was in those days. And the ship was taking evasive action. Then the Swordfish started to come in towards it. And Prince Eugen, as it turned out to be later on, we didn't know it at the time, she lowered all her guns and she fired into the sea ahead of the approaching Swordfish and sent up a great column of spray. And these Swordfish, with the most amazing bravery, ploughed straight through this. And then, of course, every gun on the ship opened up at us and at them. And then suddenly out of the murk appeared a squadron of 190s, the first time I'd seen the 190. And we were then mixed up with 190s. The Swordfish was bravely struggling through this barrage of anti-aircraft fire from the Prince Eugen and dropping one by one into the drink. And as far as I know, they were all shot down. Mostly, I think, by the guns of the Prince Eugen. And there was very little we could do about it. We were totally engaged with these 190s. That was a sad and tragic story. And it was a cock-up from the beginning to end.
Did you have any success against the 190s?
Yes, I was I was deeply angry because the first time I'd had a camera gun on my aircraft, and I got some marvellous shots of 190s. I knew I'd shot at least two down because they're right there in my camera. And when we got back to the Gravesend, the fitter came up most apologetically, said, "I'm frightfully sorry, so I forgot to take the cover off your camera gun." After we'd landed from this truly abortive mission with the six Swordfish and the Prince Eugen, when we were flying absolutely blind, and by blind I don't mean instrument blind, but I mean without any knowledge at all of what was really going on, in fact a misleading knowledge. And apparently what had happened was that a few days before, the three ships, Eisenhower, Scharnhorst, and Prince Eugen, had been bottled up in Brest in the harbour, and Bomber Command had carried out a raid on them, and photographic reconnaissance had gone over afterwards and photographed it, and had come to the conclusion that the ships were definitely hors de combat, which would take several months, if not certainly several weeks, before they could ever go to sea again. Excuse me. And there had been up to that point a submarine on permanent patrol outside to report any movement of the ships, and that was called off in the light of the photographic report after this bomber raid. What had happened, of course, really was that after the bomber raid, which hadn't been all that effective, the Germans had camouflaged a lot of damage and very cleverly made it to look as though the ships had been damaged. Anyhow, the next morning, or the morning of we were talking about when we came across the Scharnhorst and Eisenhower, a chap called Victor Beamish, who was group captain commanding RAF Kenley, took off with another pilot to do what in those days were called rhubarbs. And rhubarbs were two aircraft, when the weather was lousy, would fly over the channel at wavetop height underneath the enemy RDF, or radar, as you now call it, and would just strafe opportunity targets on the other side, gun emplacements, troop movements, trains, anything they could find, they would strafe and then get the hell out. And on the way on his rhubarb, Victor Beamish suddenly saw these three ships. And he reported them over the RT, and nobody would believe him. He said, these three bloody great battleships. And everybody on this side, they checked with the Admiralty, the Admiralty, and everybody else. And they said, it's quite impossible. There are no such three ships. It's only those three of abreast, and they can't move. We just know that. He said, well, whatever you say, there are three bloody great boats going up through, and they're about to reach the port of Calais. And so back he came. And it was on the strength of that report that we were ordered off on this mission with this totally inadequate information. And the whole thing, of course, was simply the Germans very cleverly camouflaging and exaggerating the superficial damage which Bomber Command had done, and which had in no way affected the ship's serviceability. And, of course, it was a brilliant piece of strategy, brilliant tactics by the German Navy. And they got through unscathed. This particular rather sad story started, it would be in the summer of 42, when I was wing leader at Kennedy. And we had a marvellous chaplain, a great man called Dick Atchley, known as Batchy Atchley, one of a pair of very famous flying twins. He was then a group captain, I was wing commander. He was station commander. And we had just got our first Spitfire 9 squadron, and two other wings, and I can't remember which ones, had also each got one Spitfire 9 squadron. One of them was a wing which had an American Eagle squadron, and it was due the following day, I think I'm right in saying, but the next day, to give up its RAF identity, and the pilots were going to rejoin the USAF. It was just after they'd come into the war. And it was decided that there would be a flag showing sortie over France using the three Spitfire 9 squadrons, which were a tremendous technical advance in those days. They were a marvellous airplane when they first came out. I couldn't believe them, because the performance of a Spitfire, the standard Spitfire, which was the 5 up to that moment, used to fall off quite strongly after you got to about 12 or 14, 15,000 feet, because it wasn't supercharged. And the performance just used to fall away as you got into the thinner atmosphere. And the Spitfire 9 had a two-stage blur, which cut in at around about 15,000 feet. And suddenly, when your performance was falling off, you got this huge kick up the backside, and you shot forward. It was the most marvellous feeling. And, of course, the Germans were taken quite by surprise when they came across this to begin with. Anyhow, we thought that what they would do, they would send the three 9 squadrons. I'm sorry, from three different Spitfire wings down to Bolt Head, which wasn't really an airfield, it was a strip on the south coast of Devon, and that they would do a short flight from there. I would lead the wing because I was a senior pilot, and we would take off from Bolt Head. We would climb slowly across the channel to about 20,000 feet, at which stage we would find ourselves over Morley Aerodrome, which is on the north coast of the Brest Peninsula, where we'd find a squadron of liberators. Mm-hmm. We would escort them while they bombed Morley Airfield, and they would then go back under their own steam from whence they came, and we would return to base. And it was, one couldn't imagine a simpler, less hazardous, more straightforward sortie if one tried. In the event, I was late for the briefing because I was held up by Batchy actually for some meeting or other. So when I arrived, the briefing was over. So I said, well, I'll lead my squadron as the top squadron, and you, Tony Gaze, who was in charge of one of the other squadrons, can lead the wing, and we'll have the Eagle squadron in the middle. So we set off at the duly appointed time, with me leading the top squadron and Tony Gaze leading the wing. And we got halfway across the channel, we found ourselves above. Misty cloud was slowly thickened, so that by the time we reached 20,000 feet, we were over 10 tenths cloud. And we had no way of knowing exactly where we were. We searched the sky and we couldn't see the liberators for some little time. And then finally we saw them a long way south of us, little dots. So we scurried off after them, And when we arrived, because they were over 10 tenths cloud and they didn't have any bombing aids that liberated the daylight bombers, American from the USAF. And so they waggled their wings and turned around and headed for home. And so we did exactly the same. We turned around and headed for home. Now, as we'd flown south for not more than 25 minutes, including a climb to 20,000 feet, you would imagine that flying north straight and level add another 5 or 10 minutes for the time we would take them to chase the liberators. That within 20 or 25 minutes, the most you'd be over the coast of south coast of England. But not a bit. After about half an hour of safe flying, we were still over cloud. And we were out of RT touch when we called up. There was no reply. So we plodded on and we plodded on and we plodded on, still out of RT touch. And after, I can't remember the time now, but it must have been after something like 3/4 of an hour flying north. Suddenly, through a small gap in the cloud, was a broken south coast, rugged and cliff-landy and heading looking exactly like the south coast of Devon or Cornwall. And so the Eagle Squadron, which was flying in the middle, said, ha-ha, this is it, chaps. And they peeled off and went down through and landed and or disappeared from our view. And I don't know why it was that I didn't quite like it somehow. I think perhaps it was simply that I couldn't get any reply from ops. They were still out of touch. But it didn't feel right. The vibes were wrong. So I continued to stooge on north. And we went on and we went on. After something like another, I don't know, 20 minutes or so, we were getting very low on fuel. We still couldn't see the ground. And I thought, crikey, I've really done it now. And then slowly the haze disappeared beneath us. We were over sea, could only see sea. And I thought, I've really done it. That must have been the south coast of Cornwall. I've overshot Cornwall. I'm now over the Irish Sea. So what do I do? And at that particular stage, very faintly on the RT, came the voice of ops. Where are you? Where are we? I said. They said, well, you've just got back on our board. You've been off our board for the last half hour. Fly due north. So to cut a long story short, pulling the throttle right back to the lowest possible revs, and with our nose gently down to keep ourselves going, we cruised on north, and a couple of people dropped off into the sea. They were picked up later with engines failure through lack of fuel. And a couple more engines stopped as they touched down in Bolthead, and we finally got back to Bolthead. And I think it must have been the first ever recorded or known case of the jet stream, because we were off Fighter Command's board for something like, I don't know, 3/4 of an hour or more. We just disappeared south, right out of their range. One of the liberators subsequently we discovered had landed at Gibraltar, and we were just blown miles off course. And that south coast which we saw, the broken south coast, was in fact the south coast of the Brest Peninsula. And the Eagle Squadron landed with some of its Spitfire lines intact, which the Germans were then able to get hold of. And of course, that was quite a big setback to us, because they were able to steal our technology.
What is an Eagle Squadron?
Well, the Eagle Squadrons were to begin with, at the very early part of the war, Americans used to come to us by joining the Canadian Air Force. And then they get posted over, and they would join RAF squadrons. And the RAF squadrons at the outset of the war were the best we ever had, because they were a complete mixture. You had English, you had New Zealanders, you had Australians, you had Rhodesians, you had Americans, you had Canadians. They were a lovely mishmash of people, and everybody got on extremely well. And it was frightfully good, I think, for international rapport. Then slowly, of course, nationalism took over, and so they then started forming Australian squadrons and Rhodesian squadrons and New Zealand squadrons and so on. And they put the Americans into what they call Eagle Squadrons, because they were still in RAF uniform, but they were all Americans flying Spitfire, and they called them Eagle Squadrons. And then later on in the war, and I think, as I said, this particular flight I'm talking about was the day before the Eagle Squadrons were going to be reabsorbed into the USAF. And so they reabsorbed less this one squadron. It was a great tragedy. Some of them, we lost almost two squadrons, because the other squadron, half of them disappeared too. And some were killed, some POW. Some landed intact. Some shot down. I heard also, yes, at one stage, I heard American voices saying, for God's sake, I forgot what ops control call then was, but stop these goddamn Pongos shooting at us. We're trying to land, and they keep shooting at us. Well, of course, they were shooting at them because they were German aircraft seeing these RAF-marked Spitfires coming into land.